Hello, it's Denise from Women Beyond a Certain Age. Oh, I know I say this every single podcast, but I am really excited about our guest today. We will run out of time, and if we're lucky, Debbie will come back and talk to us again. So our guest today is Debbie Gendler. Now, Debbie has written a book called I Saw Them Standing There, Adventures of an Original Fan During Beatlemania and Beyond. Now, I can't say enough nice things, but I need to say this. I've known Debbie for, I think, 20 or 25 years. I knew a little bit about this part of her background, and I'm just so proud of her and so amazed that she sat down and did this. So, hello, Debbie, and welcome to Women Beyond a Certain Age.
Thank you, Denise. I am so happy to be here as a follower of yours online. I have listened to many, many other women. And when the book was published, I said, I really want to be on Denise's show.
Oh.
Because I felt that my story, although, yes, a Beatles story with the Beatles in the background, and they were the ones who prompted everything, it's really a woman's story.
Absolutely.
And it's a woman's story that is coming of age, even to my age now, in the 70s. It's come to age.
Now, Debbie, let me tell our audience just a couple of things. I've known you because you were a television producer. And I don't mean just a television producer. I mean a woman that I knew. I think the first time I met you, Debbie, was the home show.
Yes.
On Woody Fraser's home show. Now, this is going back in the 80s. I worked with you on other TV shows that you were a producer on. You would ask me and I became a guest on several of them. Huge to do that for someone, by the way, you know that. But Debbie's produced like 9,000 episodes on TV. And I love, Deb, when I got your book, when I saw that the foreword was written by Rob Weller, people that have lived in LA or people that know television at all will know that Rob Weller was huge in the 80s and 90s. And just, I mean, huge. Weller Grossman, if people don't remember, were the original people that the original production company behind TV Food Network and Home and Garden Channel and all of them. So it's really, we go back a long way.
Mm-hmm. We sure do. And Denise, every time there was a food segment, I would be in a meeting and they say, well, who could do this? And I said, I know who.
I know.
Denise can do it. And, you know, you came very close to actually being a family member on Home and Family on the Hallmark Channel. But then the network decided, oh, they didn't want to do family members per se. But you were on at least once a week. It was always a joy to see you.
Oh, my glory years. Actually, I don't feel that way, but I have to tell you, I'm really grateful because I know it taught me a lot. It taught me a lot about myself. It taught me a lot about the business world. It was a good experience. Now, back to your book, and here's why. I said enough. If people, I should say this, a four-time Emmy nominated talent and development executive and producer. So again, formerly with CBS, this is a long history in television, Debbie. It's very impressive. It's very impressive. Now, here's what I want to say. I have read your book. What's really interesting to me, and I do this sometimes, I started about halfway through. I don't know why. A page caught my eye and I just started reading it. Then I had to go back and read the beginning until where I got to. And what I want you to do, because I want it in your words, you have to tell us how you got to be at the Beatles concert, the Beatles taping at the Ed Sullivan show that night. Because I know people that are listening to us. See, I remember watching Ed Sullivan, and when the Beatles came on, I was screaming. I didn't know who they were before that. But my father kept saying, what's the matter with those girls? Because, of course, I come from a family of three girls. And we fell in love with the Beatles when we watched them on Ed Sullivan. So how did you get to be a witness to history?
Yeah, well, Denise, I was screaming too. The only difference was is that I happened to be in the studio and you were watching on your TV, but it's the same screaming. What happened is that family, well, I was at age 13, my mom thought that I should still be greeted by someone at home when I came home from school. She was a working mom. And although it wasn't a permanent job, she worked in my dad's business. You know, she was there pretty much. So I should be greeted by someone. This young woman watched American Bandstand every day. So I had to sit there with her when I came home and watch American Bandstand. Her parents took a trip to the UK and they didn't know what to buy me, but they knew that I watched American Bandstand every day with their daughter. So I must love music. They went into a record store and they said, what's your best-selling record? And the fellow said, oh, these guys from up north, the Beatles, this is what you should bring back to her. So they bought the album, brought it back to me. And I want to tell you, this was late April or early May, not sure the date, 1963. The Beatles had not come to America yet. No one knew them. And as I say, no one knew them. I didn't know them. They hadn't been on American Bandstand. Gotcha. So I got this album. I opened it up. It was in this sort of oiled brown utility paper wrapped up with a string. And I opened it up and I looked at them and I thought, oh, are these guys cute? I fell in love. Now, I hadn't heard the music yet. I just looked at their pictures on the album cover. They had long hair, short by our standards today, but long hair. And then when I played the album, their music was beautiful. The song Please Please Me, Love Me Do.
Yeah.
It just spoke to me. I love the songs. And the next day at school, I asked two of my friends, Lynn and Terry, to come home to listen to my album. They didn't like them. And they especially didn't like their pictures on the cover with the long hair. They didn't like them. They left. They said, let's go get a pizza. Remember, this was New Jersey, so it was easy to get a piece of pizza. Let's go get a pizza. So I was left with desperately trying to find someone. Inside of the album, attached to the receipt, was if you love the Beatles, they left the receipt in because they thought it would be cute with the pound sterling,
sure. You know,
whatever. And it said, if you love the Beatles, write a letter to their fan club. So after a couple of weeks in desperation, I wrote a letter and said, please let me join your fan club. I never heard back. I never gave up hope. And I played the album over and over again. The babysitter quit because she couldn't stand listening to the album anymore. And I went away to sleepaway camp like I did to Maine every year. And as I sort of have explained to people, other girls sort of smuggled in cigarettes. Not me. I put my Beatle album in the bottom of my steamer trunk. Because every time to time, I would take a look. We went on a trip from Maine to North Conway, New Hampshire. Even though it was summer, it was a beautiful ski resort that they brought us to for the day. Everyone bought postcards in North Conway to send home to their family. Not me. I bought 3 5-cent stamps, a postcard. I remembered the fan club address. because I would stare at that letter all the time. And I wrote, "Fan club, remember me, Debbie Gendler, Oakland, New Jersey." And I put airmail and I sent it to the fan club. No postcard to my parents. So never hearing back.
No postcard to my parents.
No postcard to my parents, to Beatle fan club. So not hearing back. I still, though, never gave up hope. And I still played the album. And amazingly, it was right around Halloween. I came home from school and my mother had a yellow telegram
from oh my God. Union
in her hand from a law office in New York City. The town I lived in was about 26 miles away from Manhattan. And it said, planning trip for the Beatles to America. We're looking for fans to support their arrival. Please contact us, whatever. My mother, thank goodness for her, called up and asked what it's all about. And they said, would your daughter be able to come and meet with us? And my mom said, sure, she would. So about 10 days later, and it was great because it was Veterans Day and school was closed. You know, school would close on Veterans Day every year.
Yes.
In New Jersey. And my dad drove me to New York. I met Walter Hoffer. That was the lawyer whose law office the telegram came from. And I met Brian Epstein, the Beatles manager, who was there, who was talking to two other men, all with beautiful British accents. And Brian stood there with glistening gold cufflinks. And I was introduced to him and the other two men, as my dad was. And he said, we're looking for people to organize fans and help run the fan club. And I said, because of course I didn't even know his name at that point. It's only,
right.
It was only then. I didn't know what he looked like or his name. And I said, Mr. Epstein. He goes, no, no, no. He goes, it is Epstein, not Steen. So I said, okay. I said, Mr. Epstein. I said, I can't do that. I have to go to college. I can't work. I was all of 13. But he was lovely and kind to me and sweet as could be, as was Walter Hoffer's secretary, who the meeting was over in like 20 minutes, okay? And we left. But the secretary called me over and said, I want to confirm your name and the spelling, your address, your phone number. We think we're going to need you eventually. We will need you. And to thank you, if Mr. Epstein meets with Ed Sullivan later today as planned, and they agree on a date for the Beatles to appear on Mr. Sullivan's show, we will send you a ticket. And that's how I got my ticket to go.
Debbie, what you just described, now there's so many issues here. We have to say one or two. One, your perseverance, that you decided that you were going to meet the Beatles. I mean it. You, I love it so much. I love that you got, I love your entire book and your story because it harks back to things that no longer exist. And people don't realize getting a telegram was extraordinary. And you got a telegram. So you got a telegram that your mother said yes. Do you know what I mean? Your mother didn't say, oh, this is not a good idea. We're not working with this. That your father drove you there. I mean, these were all of those. It's like a kismet, serendipitous sort of, and All of it. And you going to camp, and I have to repeat this, not sending a postcard to your parents in 2 months, but sending one to the address you had from, you know, an album your babysitter had given you. I mean, it's beyond charming. And it kind of makes me cry for all that you've gained, but also all the things that are lost in our world. I can remember cufflinks. I still like it when I see someone who still wears cufflinks, you know, a beautifully groomed man that wears cufflinks. That's incredible. Yeah. I know people don't know this stuff anymore.
Right. You know, that's why I was so looking forward to speaking with you, Denise, because I've done a lot of podcasts with these young guys who are 22 or, you know, 34. You know, yesterday I did one with a fellow who first learned of the Beatles in 1992. I thought, are you kidding me? You know, and so what kind of questions could he really ask me? And, you know, the whole point is that the essence of my book it's threefold, really. It is, you know, act on opportunities, yes. You know, for people. I really go out and I say, you know, if an opportunity is presented, try and act on it. Don't just let it pass you by, because it will so easily. And then use those opportunities to get access, because access, you're not going to accomplish anything if you don't have access to be there at the right time. Like, I have all these friends who say, oh, like now, you know, at my age, they're divorced, they're widowed, they, you know, never been married. They want to meet the right guy. I said, well, you know what? You have to put yourself in the right place. You yeah. are not going to meet the right guy in a knitting class. You know, you're just not. You know what? Put your money together and go on something where you're going to get an upscale clientele participating. Yeah. Access is it. And then the other thing is that, and I was fortunate, you really need a willing parent who uplifts you and doesn't say, oh, a kid doesn't know. What do yeah. kids know? You know what? If I had a parent like that, I wouldn't have had my Beatle experiences. I would have never met them. I wouldn't have become friends with George's parents. Paul's brother hung out with Paul in family situations. I mean, it's like you need, and then get a job in TV as well all these years yes. and carry it forward. You cannot, as a parent or grandparent, ever say to a child, in my opinion, what do you know? Or, oh, it's only a kid. You don't know what that child's experience or a niece or a nephew can lead to down the road for them. You just don't.
Debbie, you just said it. You said it so well. I hear from women all the time through, you know, text because of the podcast, or from women that have all cooked. They were all people that have cooked in their lives. And we know it hasn't been an easy road for women to break into restaurants or into cooking. I mean, it hasn't been, but if you don't try, and if you are calling it access, if you don't say yes, you're never going to have the opportunities. When people say to me, I can't believe all the different things you did in food. And inside, and lots of times I just say to them, I said yes. When people asked me, I'd say yes. Did I know what I was doing? Not always, but it wasn't anything that was critical. I wasn't going to kill anybody by saying yes. But you know, you have to decide that you want to get the most out of your life. That's what my feeling is. And I think sometimes as women, when we're younger, all of our priorities have been placed on getting married, getting a couch, having some kids. And none of that is wrong. But I'm hoping the messages to younger women now is think about you and get and do your life, live your life. But as we get older now, you don't have children, you are widowed, whatever happens. Well, what a great time for you to do exactly as you want.
Right, right.
Get out there and live.
It's freedom, right? It's freedom as we get older. I have found that, yeah, I feel freer. I feel more confident and not depending upon others for what I would like to do. I just feel, okay, you know, my time has come. And, you know, you mentioned Rob Weller writing the foreword to my book.
Oh,
and
so
Rob
good.
Always would tell us while, you know, we would be interviewing people for jobs and kids would come in and like, you know, look at us like, I don't want to start as a production assistant. And I don't want to, I went to college to study, you know, broadcasting and I want to produce and I should be a producer. And they would leave the room and Rob would always say to me something that's always in my mind. And that is that work begets work.
That's right.
You don't say, and it's an old fashioned thing, but I think it really holds forth that you get your foot in the door, you work hard, and you get ahead and you're able to achieve. And I think that's viable in every walk of life, is that if you keep hold back and you wait for the great opportunity, that sometimes never comes.
That's right. Debbie, when you say that, especially in our social media world now, see in food, I get lots of kids. Oh, I want to have the career you had. I said, okay, that now let me explain what that means. That means there's a whole lot of 70-hour weeks and carrying the bag of garbage at the end of the 5,000-person party, or getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to get to a TV station. Do you know what I mean? I mean, people, it looks good from the outside, but I think for sustainability, which is what Debbie, you're really talking about. No, you don't come into a production office and think you're going to be the boss. That's not how it works. And I don't think that works in any career, though it seems to have fallen. People think, oh, with social media and they have a lot of followers, this person can be what they want to be. But you know what? It's not sustainable. You have to have done the work. The old-fashioned hard work pays off to get where you want to go. At least I think that's way, because I get phone calls. The statistics, and I'm sure this is very similar in television and lots of, in television producing, of somebody who's in the business 20 years later. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Chefs and food stylists, cater or whatever, they don't last 20 years because they give up after 5 or 10 because it's really hard work and they have to work long hours.
Right, right. And you have to realize that families and days, you know, when I was doing Home and Family, we shot a show even on New Year's Day. I went for 6 years working on New Year's Day. So you know what? You have to be prepared. Yeah, we ended taping and I got home at around 5 o'clock, but still I was there at the studio at 9 o'clock in the morning on New Year's Day.
I always like
prepared.
It, Deb, when people would say to me, well, I've contacted the show 2 or 3 times. I sent them a package. No one ever got back to me. I said, have you ever seen the desk of a television producer that's busy?
Right.
I said, Do you have any idea how many hours those people work? No, people, it's a different world, except as I see things not working, I think we can go back to some real simple truths, and hard work pays off. Okay, that perseverance pays off in your case. Now, so here you are. We said it. I know, what was it like to be sitting in the audience that night? And I'll tell you why I asked this. I told you already, my sisters and I were screaming, here's a word from the past, in the rumpus room of my parents' new home. We had a nice TV and we watched Ed Sullivan religiously. So that was not unusual, but I was screaming, my sisters were screaming. When we got to school, the next day, there were already girls in my class. I think I was in seventh grade going into eighth grade the next year. There were already, already girls in my class that said that they were going, they were already talking about it. They were going to run away to meet the Beatles. Mm-hmm. And I came home from school and I said to my mother, Dixie and someone else, these were not close friends of mine. Dixie, I can see their faces. They were, they had said to me in gym class, we're going to run away to see the Beatles. And I said, really? And I told my mother that. And she said, well, you're not running away to see the Beatles. And I thought, no, I'm not. Later on, they did run away. It was in the local independent journal. They got as far as Market Street on the bus in San Francisco, and somebody went and got them. But I mean, it was Beatle mania.
It was. It was. Well, you know, when I got to the theater that night, and it was pretty much a fight to even get my seat. Okay. I got into the theater, and first of all, and I think your listeners will enjoy this, is that it was really important for me to choose the right outfit, because I spent a whole day in my closet. Well, should I wear this or that? Because if a Beatle saw me, oh my goodness, I had to look grown up and dressed properly. So that was torturous, getting dressed that day. And when I left, my mother drove me, not my dad. My mom drove me into New York that day. She gave me one of her necklaces. I still remember it because I felt so grown up, you know. So Okay. Anyway, well, we fought our way in.
You had to look gorgeous because one of them was going to see you and marry you on
the spot. And then I'd get to go back to England and have a beautiful accent like Brian Epstein. Okay.
Oh, I'm there with you, Deb. I'm there with you.
So I go up there. I go into the theater. They grabbed my ticket. I said, could I have a souvenir? No. Mm-mm. There are no known existing tickets from that show.
Wow.
It's been told that perhaps Walter Cronkite's daughter has one, because Walter brought his two daughters and his wasn't confiscated, but I've never had a conversation to confirm that. But there are none. And I got to my seat and I'm looking around, and the gal behind me is already bouncing. The one to my right is there also. And I was there all alone because I only got one ticket. So I couldn't bring my mom. Other people I saw brought a parent, but they got their tickets. You know, that's the thing. I got my own ticket, basically.
Yes.
It's not that my dad worked for J. Walter Thompson or Kenyard and Eckhart, that my dad worked or granddad worked for Lincoln Mercury, the sponsors. That, you know, it wasn't that world for me. And so a lot of adults brought 2 and 3 fans with them. But I sat there and I decided I was going to be adult and not scream. And of course, I was a little upset that I was put in the mezzanine and not the orchestra. But boy, did that prove fabulous. Because out of nowhere, Ed Sullivan did the, and ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles. And everyone started to scream. And so did I. Because as much as I wanted to like maintain my calm, I couldn't. It was impossible. And you know, the funny thing is, and, you know, it probably was indeed I was going to end up working in television, because right prior to the Beatles coming on, there was a monitor on the side, a studio monitor, and I could see playing the commercials. And it was an Aniston commercial. And I still remember thinking to myself, boy, is this crew there, the people that work there, gonna need Aniston after this show, because the screaming was already so loud in the studio. I just knew that Aniston was in their future. And so the Beatles magically appeared out of nowhere. I will never, ever forget those first notes of all my loving. Oh my goodness. And the thing is that the mezzanine proved to be a great seat because the Beatles, when they came on, they didn't look down towards the orchestra that much. There were a lot of cameras there.
Yes, of course.
People's view. They like looked up. And they were looking up at all of us in the mezzanine. And it was so special. And so we were there a bit on an incline and we looked down and we could see them almost, I could almost see to their shoulders, like their faces. And I, each time, each moment, I like looked at Paul and Ringo and John and George and looked over again at John. What I did miss that I learned later is they did little chyrons under each name.
Yes.
John, and then when they got to John, they said, John, sorry, girls, he's married. Well, I, of course, never saw that in the studio. I couldn't
okay.
see it. It was just for people at home.
Okay. I saw it. I read it. Now, let's get down to brass tacks here for 1 minute. Who did you love the most immediately?
You know, Denise, that is a beyond difficult question for me that I really can't answer. Okay?
Okay.
I truly, truly cannot answer that. What I can say, though, that I do know from all my later associations and with the fan club is that Ringo was the most popular Beatle in America. It wasn't Paul, John, or George. It was Ringo. And Ringo, by far, was the most popular Beatle. Then came Paul. Then it was a tie, George and John. And as things evolved, you know, people got it. What was beautiful about the Beatles, if you want to compare them to, let's say, Elvis?
Yes.
With Elvis, there was only one Elvis to love.
Yeah.
The Beatles, there were four to love.
Okay.
So friends, right? And you'll relate to this. Friends could all love the Beatles together, but one loved Paul more, and one loved John more, and one loved the quiet Beatle or the mop top Ringo shaking his head. So it let girls really express their own individuality, yet be together. And there were fights in groups. No, I love Paul more than you. And you love Paul, and he's mine. And you have to choose another Beatle because he's my favorite Beatle. Oh my goodness. You know, I went for a long time wanting to call my book, not I Saw Them Standing There, but Who's Your Favorite Beatle? Because it was wartime between friends till that was established. But once it did, it was great.
Okay, now I need to tell you something. I love Paul, okay? Because now when I look back and when you see pictures of them when they were just came, they were all beautiful. Do you know what I mean? But I remember, and those big brown eyes, but I remember that Paul, I loved Paul more than anything. And you already mentioned this, but this is not a proud moment in my life. Debbie, I took down my Elvis pictures. I had my mother, very much a decorator. I had a canopy bed and everything matched, and that French provincial furniture that was big in the 60s. Very feminine, pink and white and tassels and all this stuff. So when I tacked with thumbtacks pictures of Elvis Presley on the wall next to the ballet things that were framed that my mother had, she was horrified. And then she said, well, you've already ruined the wall. You might as well leave the picture. I loved Elvis more than anything. And then I dumped Elvis like a hot potato. When my sister, who's a few years older, came home with the I Want to Hold Your Hand album, we played it until, I think we had to buy it again. I'm serious. We played it until it was either scratched or too thin or warped. And I'm so sorry. And we did have several of their albums. And Debbie, years ago, I gave them to a kid that worked for me that, you know, collected vinyl. When I was reading your book, I thought, oh, if only I'd kept those albums to give to Debbie.
You know, I did the same thing with, in the book, you probably enjoyed that part, with Richard Chamberlain.
Yes.
I had pictures of Dr. Kildare up in my room because I loved him. And I pulled them down and I put up the poster that's behind me on the cover of my book, the 6 foot tall poster, because that picture was taken of me on my bed the day after I met the Beatles. And that poster I put up in place of Richard Chamberlain. And then years later, I met him and I felt so guilty that I pulled down, but I really pulled it down and like threw it in the trash and put up those that Beatles poster. I felt badly for the did that.
I think you have a line in your book saying fame is fleeting. I think. No, honey, you need to tell people when there is the cover of the book. And I know that you have memorabilia, but I need people to understand that this wasn't just you have kept in touch, you mentioned it, with family members and the Beatles since then. Tell us how that happened.
Well, you know, after I met the Beatles in 1965, and, you know, I don't want to say I got that out of my system, but it was quite an ordeal for me to see that through. I then started to do things, and I had previously and after, and that's how I got to meet them, maintained relationships with the Beatles and the families. I started a correspondence with George's mother, Louise Harrison, who was the kindest, most wonderful person. She would send me snippets in the mail of George's clothing, his sock, his shirt, pieces of his shirt, all sorts of things. Did all that. And I wrote letters and we wrote back and forth to each other from late 1964 until her death in 1970. I mean, we wrote continuously, and I'm not the only fan that she wrote to. She wrote to other fans too, but I was one of her main corresponders.
Okay? That's incredible.
So it was really wonderful. And after all my work for the Beatles, doing local TV, helping answer fan mail, devoting things in the fan club, like hours and hours, and doing errands. And a lot of it was fun, going on TV, representing the fan club and doing all of that. I got invited to go to England in 1967. Brian asked me, had I ever been to England? No. And this was like around October of 66. I said, no. He goes, well, England is beautiful in April. Why don't you plan a trip? So Brian's assistant, who was a woman by the name of Wendy Hansen, started to arrange my trip. And I was in excellent, excellent hands. Until December 1966, plans were going beautifully, when I received a letter from Wendy, and she said, I'm leaving working for Brian.
Oh.
I was devastated, because what was I going to do then without Wendy there, who was making all the arrangements? So she introduced me to the woman, Jody, who was her assistant. And I received, and I have letters, all of this in my book, actually. The letter
yes.
from Wendy and the letter from her assistant saying to keep in touch and she'll pick up where Wendy left off. But I knew in my heart that was not going to happen. because I had had one-on-one with Wendy. We had seen each other and knew each other. So I started to make my own arrangements for this April 1967 trip. And one of them was with Mrs. Harrison. So I wrote Mrs. Harrison and I said, I want you to know through Wendy, I'm coming. So, and I'm coming with my mom. She said, okay, why don't you both come up here to Liverpool? Because, and this is the reason, you know, this woman, she wouldn't think the reason I want to go to Liverpool is to see the cavern, to see this, to see that, to meet her. No, she goes, clothes are much cheaper in Liverpool than they are in London. Now, I did not go to England, really. Yeah, I wanted to buy like a mod dress and mod shoes and go to Carnaby Street and the store Granny Takes a Trip or Mary Quant, right? All of that. I wanted to go and do all this, but it wasn't for clothes. I wanted to go and see and meet her. So in the end, after lots of correspondence, my mom decided to remain in London, and she put me on a train at Euston Station. I was already 17 in 1967. So I wasn't that 13, 15
year old.
Yes. I was already 17. She, newly 17, because my birthday in March, I had just turned 17, but still. And Mrs. Harrison would pick me up at the stop in their town called Warrington, which she did. And I went and stayed at their home for 2 nights.
Oh,
I had also written a letter to Angela and Jim McCartney. Jim, a few years before, had gotten remarried. He was a widow for many, many years. And he married this woman, Angela. And I wrote them a letter to their home. And Angela said, why don't you, when you get up to Liverpool area, ring her up and she'll see what she can do. So I brought that letter along. Well, I showed it to Mrs. Harrison and she go, oh, we're ringing her up. We'll go see her tomorrow if she's home. So she rang her up and we went over there and I met them. And while I was there, it was very short, but enough to have a cup of tea there in their home. So I was there at the McCartney home with the Harrisons and with Angela and Jim McCartney. Unbelievable.
And unbelievable.
Out of the blue comes Paul's younger brother, Michael McCartney. And this is how I established my many, many years relationship with Michael and the family. And Michael was running out. He had an appointment in Liverpool. And I still remember him because he was wearing a black jacket. He was carrying a leather little like notebook case or something that was tied. He said, hello. He didn't even have enough time to even know if I was English or American or what I was doing there. Boom. So Michael left. And that was it until, a few years later, I was in my dorm at college in Boston. I went to school in Boston and I read that Mike McCartney and his band or group, that he was an improvisational, and he called himself Mike McGear at the time, not McCartney, because he wanted to distinguish himself a little bit from Paul. They were called The Scaffold, were playing The Bitter End in New York. And it was right at Thanksgiving time. So I left school a couple days earlier than Thanksgiving and went home to New Jersey and stayed at my grandmother's apartment in New York. And I went to see Mike at the Bitter End. And I said, do you remember me? This, and he didn't really. I said, we were dashing out, but I was there. Do you remember Mr. and Mrs. Harrison stopping by? He said, yeah, a few times. I said, well, I was there with them. And anyway, we had a whole long conversation about what he was doing. And so I actually did make myself known to him on that date. Now, fast forward many years, I was working CBS New York, and that was pure coincidence, had nothing to do with going to the Ed Sullivan Show. And they decided to transfer me to LA. And so I moved out to Los Angeles to continue working for them. And I read, again, that Mike McCartney was coming to Los Angeles to publicize his new book, Mike Mack's Family Album. And this was 1981. And I said to my husband, you know, they were all so nice, and Jim and Mike was really nice at the bitter end. Let's throw a party. So I called this publisher, and the publisher said, sure, if you want to pay for the whole thing, we're happy to do it. And I said, I'll pay for the whole thing. It was Paul and I. We were both working. We had no children at the time.
Yes, I
We were
hear you.
there. Yeah, hey, we'll pay. And so Mike came, and that's where our very long friendship started. But the party was amazing. I had Graham Nash, Little Richard, Joan Collins and her husband, Mike
Ah.
Bass, who came. I mean, it and her daughter, Katie. I mean, Spencer Davis from the Spencer Davis Group that showed Give Me a Little Lovin', Give Me a Little Lovin'. I mean, and lots of Liverpool people, Brits living in LA came. I mean, it was a great, great party. And we, from that point on, always stayed friends. My husband did work for Mike and associated stuff like that. My husband's a lawyer, did other kinds of work like that. And we always stayed friends. I mean, so much so, Mike came to LA for my daughter's wedding. I went there. We
Oh.
had wonderful times. And Denise, I know you having your, San Francisco childhood, one of my best experiences with Mike was going up to San Francisco, because he did the morning show, not in 85, it was a few years later. He did photo exhibits that I set up. I think it was in 89 or something. He did a show, a morning show on WKPIX, right? Was that on Battery Street? Whatever
At
was on
W
Battery.
KPIX, the
Okay.
original studio was on Van Ness,
Okay.
and Van Ness at Greenwich and Filbert. And I know that because the apartment house my family owned for 70 years was next door to KPIX.
Okay. Well, that's
And
where we went,
okay.
KPIX, to do
W.
a morning show there.
Oh,
And
yes.
yeah, it was really, really wonderful. And so we had great times even in San Francisco and in Liverpool and here in LA and down in Mexico and on vacation, all sorts of fun stuff over the years. So that's how, and in these relationships and not detail, but that's how I got to see Paul, Linda in family settings, not in just performance. Although I do have a
Yes.
couple of great backstage incidents that I do relate in the book, but I also relate in the book a few of the family things, and especially with Linda. And I produced Yoko TV shows with Yoko and Linda's cooking segments with Linda, but things like that. So I had a lot of interaction.
Debbie, I as I said about reading your book, and I said this to you in an email before we're here on the air. I love the description of the parties, the party that you gave Mike and the people that came. And of course you would turn around and be able to produce some TV segments for, Linda. I said to you must have kept the most incredible diary to have all these details. And you said to me, no, I just, but, and Rob Weller says this in the foreword that you have a mind, it's a steel trap, a memory that, which is so impressive. When I write about my past, Deb, I do see that I can trigger memories. Do you know what I mean? I can remember things that I had forgotten. Do you know what I mean? If you have to work on that. But your book is so filled with rich detail that that's what makes it joyful to read. I mean it. It's just, and I said this to you, but I want to say it live. I read all the time. I read memoirs. I read autobiography. I read biographies. I read about people. I'm not into sci-fi or anything too much like that, but I love to read about people and their lives because it's fascinating to me that we all have stories. That's what makes life interesting. And so your book is so well written and has these wonderful details and images of a world. Since you're going through decades, you get to glimpse back at things that no longer exist. And I love that. Do you know what I mean? I love to be reminded of things that no longer exist. And I think it's important that some people that don't even know they exist should find out about them.
Very, very true. You know, I look at this book, there are two things about the book. First of all, at the very last page, I set up a little domain name and it's Debbie at I saw them standing there. .com because I wanted people to write me, email me, let me know their experiences, because everyone has, whether it was just, you know, 2 months ago seeing Ringo perform with his all-star band in a concert in, you know, Chicago or whatever. Everyone seems to have a really wonderful memory or firsthand experience of seeing them. That's beautiful. And the theme of why I wrote the book really and whatever is the Beatles represented to me and to millions of others a way to celebrate the good times of our lives. And I think that celebrating the good times of our lives is very much needed today when principles are of you know, tolerate even others who don't have the same ideas. Try and convince them to change them to maybe your ideas. It was a time of greater kindness, and I don't mean to only say the Ringo, oh, easily, peace and love, peace and love. You know what? That's a nice commercial kind of thing to say. But you know what? It really is where the Beatles represented to us, and I think still do to so many, that it was the good time of our lives.
You said it. And I have nothing but admiration, well, for Ringo and Paul, for all of them. And I say this, look at him still working.
Right.
Look at Ringo and Paul too, but Ringo Starr has put out so many albums. And sometimes I have Sirius Radio, so I can play the Beatles channel. Do you know what I mean? But when they have interviews of people, and especially one of them was Ringo, and he was just talking about these four kids and how they, and here they were, the Beatles and Beatlemania, but they only got in one room. Yes. So that they, one room with single beds, so that they were together 24 hours a day. And I mean, the camaraderie just never quits when you hear them talk about each other. It's pretty impressive. And was the world kinder? I think so, Debbie, or at least maybe we, I always say this because of the internet and social media, which I love, I'm not, but we know more about ugliness now than we ever did.
Yeah.
Though I will say this, and this is, I don't want to end on a downer, but you know, the day that John Lennon was shot, I was in my early 30s, I think, and I was selling real estate and I lived in Novato. I hadn't gone to cooking school yet. And my best friend, who only lived a couple of miles away, drove over and we made a pot of tea. And at that moment, I knew the world had changed in a way that I didn't even want to deal with. Do you know what I mean? And when you look back at the violence that we experience now, but just the different things with guns, I was right.
Right. You were right. You were right. And, you know, it's, I, at the day, 2 days after John Lennon was shot, a picture of me was on the front page of the LA newspaper. After careful consideration, and I cleared it and everything with the paper, I got the rights, yeah. I figured yeah. it out. I yanked it from the book because I just felt it was not appropriate. I did not want my picture seen under the headline, John Lennon murdered, whatever.
I get it. I
just didn't want that association because, yes, I mean, we had all at that age experienced so much, from the JFK to seeing a live murder on TV of Lee Harvey Oswald. I mean, seeing someone actually murdered, to then you had Martin Luther King, you had, you know, Harvey Milk. We had gone through so much. And then yes. John Lennon, a hero, an idol. So, you know, all these reasons I pulled together in the book. Some I explain more than others, because like the John Lennon murder, I have no explanation for that.
I know.
It's such a nightmare and a horror. The only thing that I am always upset about is that he's called a fan. And
I
cringe at that. He's not a fan.
No.
He's not a fan, or even a deranged fan. A fan does not, by the definition, do that. Even deranged, you know? It's like the guy wasn't. He's like a monster, you know? Yeah. He's not a fan. So I really take exception with that. And that's why I really didn't include that much on it. And I felt everyone has their own opinion, and we pretty much have lived through it in that way.
Perfectly said. Perfectly said. Deb, I cannot thank you enough for your time. I know how busy you've been. I know that you went to New York. There's been events with People Magazine, and I saw that a clip of it. I know how busy you've been. So for you to take this time and talk to us this morning, I want people to remember the name of the book is I Saw Them Standing There, Adventures of an Original Fan During Beatlemania and Beyond, Debbie Gendler, G-E-N-D-L-E-R. And honey, I said this before, I'm repeating it to you. I'm a big reader. It was uplifting to read your book. And also uplifting that I know people had said to you for years, decades, why don't you write a book? Why don't you write a book? Well, guess what? You did.
I did, after all of it. But Denise, it's been my honor and pleasure to do this, because we know each other from a professional food working relationship, that you were always the prima go-to person who I depended upon when everyone nervously said food, food, food on the show. But I really wanted to be able to share this very personal other side of myself with you and Cindy and your listeners. So thank you so much for this opportunity. I so appreciate it.
If people want to reach out, when we broadcast, in case anyone is new, when we broadcast, Cindy puts this up on Facebook, our Facebook website, all of the different things for women beyond a certain age. And we give you Debbie's information so that you can contact her. So we'll put that, I Saw Them Standing There website, or what you've set up, Debbie, so people can reach out to you. If not that, people sometimes are embarrassed and they private message me first, and I say, fine. So people can always reach us at womenbeyond@icloud.com. And Debbie, I cannot thank you enough. That's all I can say. I cannot thank you enough.
Thank you.
This has just been, it's been uplifting to me to talk to you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Miss Cindy, for keeping the train on the tracks. And it's not always an easy... I'm not always easy. I want to thank you, Debbie and Cindy, and for everyone that listens to us. And I really appreciate people that... post us or send me a message that say that they learned something from the website or just enjoyed it. And if that's good enough for me. So thank you, ladies. Thank you so much. Bye.